Chapter 39. If Dorothy Kilgallen found reason to investigate Marilyn's death, as the suspicions expressed in her column suggest, she surely would have questioned additional aspects of Marilyn's tragic demise. For instance, Kilgallen would have wondered why and how the telephone receiver was clasped in Marilyn's hand. This fact lends credence, once again, to the death scene being carefully arranged by either Dr. Engelberg and/or Dr. Greenson, since there appears to exist no logical reason why the two men would have left the phone receiver in her hand other than to confuse the crime scene by making it appear Marilyn was on the phone when she died. If Kilgallen had probed her friend's death as thoroughly as she had the JFK assassination, no doubt that would have included interviewing both Engelberg and Greenson so as to discover the truth about the phone receiver issue, perhaps by checking phone records to determine whether Marilyn was actually on a call, and if so, with whom. As it was, no evidence exists that anyone, including the police, ever checked the phone records. This kind of apparent staging parallels Kilgallen's own death scene, where the book The Honey Badger by Robert Ruark, a book Kilgallen had already read, was carefully positioned as discovered by Mark Sinclair. To date, no explanation for the phone receiver in Marilyn's case or the book on Kilgallen's lap in her case has ever been convincing, least of all conclusive. Instead, the natural inclination is to believe that both women just drifted off into their next life without anyone causing them to die at such early ages, which places the blame for those deaths squarely on them, blunting any accusations they were murdered, the intended objects of the stage death scenes. In addition, two more factors about Marilyn's death scene would have, in all likelihood, caused Kilgallen concern. First, why was Marilyn found in the nude? If truly intent on suicide, she would have known that when her body was discovered, all sorts of strangers, including police, perhaps even reporters, would have viewed her remains. Kilgallen, if she had investigated, would have questioned why Marilyn had no bedclothes, or any clothes on, for that matter, causing her nude body to be exposed to onlookers. Second, Kilgallen must have wondered why neither her doctor nor her psychiatrist had the decency to cover Marilyn up before the authorities arrived. If these two men really cared about her, then during the consultation that Kilgallen mentioned in one of her columns, they could have easily decided to cover her with at least a sheet. That they didn't do so speaks to their lack of character, or to the very real possibility that one or both of them were involved with her death, although they may have argued that their lack of courtesy was because they didn't want to alter the death scene, a rather feeble excuse, it would seem. When it comes to providing additional insight regarding means and opportunity as to how Marilyn Monroe was murdered, Kilgallen's next comment in her column about Marilyn's death must be examined. Unfortunately, that comment provides more questions than answers. She wrote, "Why the big time gap in such a small town? Mrs. Murray gets worried at about 3 a.m., and it's almost 6 a.m. before the police get to the scene." The latter time conflicts with other time frames being suggested, but must still be seriously considered. Kilgallen knew that Dr. Engelberg and Dr. Greenson had sufficient amount of time in Marilyn's bedroom to alter the death scene in several possible ways, including the location of her body, the positioning of the empty Nembutal bottle, or the removal of other likely objects of interest. Like in Kilgallen's case, where an empty Seconal bottle at the death scene caused the detectives to quickly assume she had either committed suicide or died accidentally, the empty Nembutal bottle near Marilyn's bed served the same purpose. Missing among any of the police statements, it appears, is information as to what Eunice Murray actually saw after one of the doctors bashed open the bedroom window to gain entry since the bedroom door was locked. Kilgallen would have figured that Murray did not enter the bedroom through the window, but waited until Engelberg unlocked the door for her. In addition, Kilgallen would have questioned what Murray was doing all this time. After the bedroom door was unlocked for her, did she enter the bedroom and then immediately return to her housekeeping duties? Or was she present when Engelberg and Greenson were figuring out their strategy as to when and how to let police know of Marilyn's death and, more importantly, the death scene those police would view when they arrived? In addition, Kilgallen would have been concerned about Eunice Murray's statements, which vary considerably through different interviews over the years. These variations range from seeing the light under Marilyn's door when she walked past it in the middle of the night to her having arisen from her bed to go to the bathroom and seeing the light then. Confusion reigns as to exactly what Murray did in order to check Marilyn's bedroom door. During most interviews, Murray said the door was locked and that while on the way to her bathroom, she noticed light visible from underneath Marilyn's door, causing her to become suspicious that something could be wrong. However, when checking the home's layout, it seems unlikely/impossible she could have simply walked by Marilyn's door after going to the bathroom, since Murray's bathroom was connected to her bedroom with no door to the hall, meaning that she could not have just passed by Marilyn's door, as she stated, without leaving her bedroom, walking into the hall, and then noticing a light under Marilyn's bedroom door. Certainly, Kilgallen would have quizzed Murray about this inconsistency or apparent lie, but what is even more disturbing is that none of the police did so, including Sergeant Clemens. As was the case with Kilgallen's death, it was sloppy work, and normal follow-up was non-existent, a sad state of affairs for sure. Without question, the granddaddy of Kilgallen's suspicions would have, in all likelihood, centered on why Eunice Murray was operating the washing machine so close to dawn, as Sergeant Clemens noticed. Surely she would have surmised there must be a good reason for that happening, including the possibility the sheets on the bed where Marilyn died were soiled, perhaps from her having thrown up on them as she passed away, or due to another bodily discharge, as will be explained. In addition, recall that, mentioned in the Noguchi coroner case report, and only there, it appears, was the fact that there was a blanket, never described, as part of the death scene, without information as to where exactly it was found and when. Since that death happened in August, when temperatures were on the warm side, the blanket being included by Noguchi in his handwriting is a red herring. If it was there, then could Murray have been washing the blanket as well as the sheets? If Kilgallen had interviewed either Clemens or Detective Sergeant Robert E. Byron, who arrived on the scene a few minutes after Clemens, she would have discovered that Clemens agreed with Byron's observations at the time. Murray was acting like an unreliable witness. It is this officer's opinion that Mrs. Murray was vague and possibly evasive in answering questions pertaining to the activities of Miss Monroe during this time. Since not one but two officers believed Murray was an unreliable witness and possibly evasive, why wasn't there follow-up based on these suspicions, since their viewpoint taints her statements about whether it was Engelberg or Greenson who arrived first at Marilyn's home and broke the window pane? If either of the officers decided to learn the truth, perhaps they were told not to do so by superiors, pointing to only one of the many cover-ups surrounding Marilyn's death. Returning to the column Kilgallen wrote on August 8, 1962, under the banner, "Martha proves she's a trooper." Recall that the dogged reporter wrote, "The mail pouring in on the subject of Marilyn Monroe's death is amazing in volume and content. Many of her fans, and some people who knew her in life, want an investigation beyond what the Beverly Hills police have conducted." Significant is her reporting that not only fans of Marilyn's were suspicious about what happened to her, but also some people who knew her in life, apparently friends and entertainment personalities as well. Kilgallen also notes that these people believe a further investigation beyond what the Beverly Hills police have conducted is required. The source of the received information that the Beverly Hills police were indeed investigating is not stated. Oddly enough, not only was that department never involved, but there was no police investigation at all, as was the case with Kilgallen's death. The quote that these people simply aren't satisfied with the brief autopsy report refers to Dr. Kerfey's conclusion of suicide being the most likely cause of Marilyn's death. Kilgallen commended those who had written to her for posing some intelligent questions, presumably ones she had as well. When Kilgallen's column is scrutinized in the context of her statement that the real story hasn't been told, while keeping in mind her having written that Marilyn had accidentally died of a drug overdose while at the same time telling her butler Marilyn was killed and that the Kennedys were involved, she was now on record as believing that the black shapes of a nightmare chasing a tortured Marilyn had hit their mark straight into the path of an onrushing locomotive. Since Kilgallen had also used, as noted, the term "the man in her life," referring to whomever the actress was involved with before she died, apparently referring to Robert Kennedy, and believing RFK was the last caller to Marilyn before she died, doesn't common sense point to him as the nightmare who was chasing a tortured Marilyn as the onrushing locomotive, since he was as powerful as a locomotive, the second most powerful man in America? Such a conclusion certainly connects with those of author Frank Capel, author Fred Lawrence Giles, and journalist Martha Donaldson, all of whom pointed the finger at RFK as the likely culprit. Regarding RFK, and for that matter certainly JFK, one may wonder why, based on her awareness of the distinct possibility that the Attorney General was complicit in Marilyn's death, Kilgallen didn't launch the same sort of in-depth investigation of him as she would do with JFK's assassination in 1963. One clue may be that just 2 months later, on October 16, 1962, world peace was threatened when the Cuban Missile Crisis hit the headlines. For 12 days, Americans held their breath, frightened that nuclear war was at hand, and, perhaps in his finest hour, RFK stood tall and helped his brother quell the threat. With this in mind, Kilgallen may have decided if she had begun to investigate further Marilyn's death and Bobby's part in it, she could not in good conscience go forward, and this stifled any further probe involving RFK. Based on her reputation for integrity, this seems a logical explanation. If this happened, Kilgallen was never able to deal with the questions she posed in the broader version of the column she had written regarding those matters that bothered her about Marilyn's death. Regardless, in effect, it appears that Marilyn Monroe had been right, as noted when she wrote in My Story, "Yes, there was something special about me, and I knew what it was. I was the kind of girl they found dead in a hall bedroom with an empty bottle of sleeping pills in her hand." Following publication of the intriguing column questioning many aspects of Marilyn's death, Kilgallen apparently wrote another one asking why the authorities had not checked on reports of Marilyn's whereabouts on the weekend before she died, an apparent reference to what happened at the Cal Neva Resort near Reno. Thus far, research to locate that column has not been fruitful. Regardless, in Kilgallen's mind, means and opportunity to end Marilyn's life existed in any number of ways, with each potentially linked to Engelberg and Greenson. If this is what Kilgallen suspected, then the crack investigative reporter would have turned her attention to motive and benefit from the crime in order to target who could have influenced or even ordered one of the doctors, or even another operative, to rob Marilyn of her life by poisoning the famous actress with lethal doses of barbiturates. While delving into the backgrounds and current status of the two doctors when Marilyn was murdered, Kilgallen would have considered who most needed Marilyn dead. She might have focused on underworld figures such as Sam Giancana or Carlos Marcello, since Kilgallen knew RFK was hounding them, and thus considered whether setting up Marilyn for the kill would have acted as a warning to Bobby that he must halt his pursuit of them, especially Marcello. Or, as noted, the gangsters intended to confiscate Marilyn's notebooks/diary and use her recollections to embarrass the Kennedys into ending their pursuit of the mobsters. If this had happened, the mobster would then use that leverage to force the Attorney General to lay off hounding Giancana, Marcello, and their cohorts. but there appears to be a gigantic common-sense hole in this theory. By all accounts, no incriminating notebooks slash diary were found when the operatives ransacked Marilyn's home, if any such documents were there in the first place. The Las Vegas Sands Hotel casino pit boss during the 1960s, previously quoted, also doubted mafia involvement in Marilyn's death. In April 2020, he told this author, "Nobody in the mob would have been involved. They wouldn't have wanted the spotlight turned on them. They didn't want the newspaper people circling the story. That's the last thing they would have allowed to happen."